Okay, if we can recommence. We are moving to paper four, is that correct? Which according to the agenda is service concessions with leased infrastructure. Wade, take it away.
All right, thank you. We'll move on to agenda paper four. So this paper continues the discussion of the recognition and presentation issue for service concession arrangements in which the infrastructure is leased and the operator is not required to provide any construction or upgrade services in respect of the infrastructure. In our previous analysis discussed with you in March, we noted that the lessor and the grantor should be considered together for arrangements in which they were both controlled by the same governmental body. This was based on our read of paragraph 82 of IPRIC 12, which was noted in paragraph 8 of the paper. We agree with the comments raised by some committee members at the last meeting that paragraph 82 is applicable in assessing the control condition in paragraph 5 of IPRIC 12 and may not be relevant to the recognition and presentation issues. Therefore, we have revisited our analysis. We think the analysis is similar, both for arrangements in which the lessor and the grantor are controlled by the same governmental body and for those arrangements in which they're not. We do not think the relationship between the lessor and the grantor necessarily affects the rights and obligations that give rise to assets and liabilities for the operator. Our analysis is presented in paragraph 11 to 26 of the agenda paper. We think that the operator should first assess whether it is obligated to make the lease-related payments to the lessor. This requires consideration of all facts and circumstances. And for example, it might more often be the case that contractual arrangements are such that in cases where the grantor and the lessor are controlled by the same governmental body, the operator may not have an obligation to make the lease-related payments. But if the operator determines that it is obliged to make the lease-related payments, it then has to assess when it should recognize the liability to make those payments. On the basis of our analysis, we think that the operator should generally recognize this liability at the start of the arrangement. With respect to presentation, we think that the operator can only offset the liability to make these payments versus the financial receivable from the grantor if it meets the offsetting criteria in IS 32. So I'd now like to hand it over to the committee and ask if you agree with our analysis, and if you do, whether you agree that the requirements in the standards provide a sufficient basis to enable the operator to determine the appropriate accounting treatment.
Talking about the conclusion summarized in paragraph 27?
Yes.
Okay. Comments and reactions? John?
I agree with the analysis. I think that I do think AG2 of IFRIC 12 is only relevant for the assessment of the control criterion and not for the recognition and presentation of assets and liabilities. So I agree with the staff conclusion. Yes.
Reinhardt?
Very similar comments. I agree with the analysis, and I think the focus on IS 32 as the basis for determining whether you offset as opposed to whether they're related, it was helpful, and I agree with that, and so I agree with the agenda decision.
Alon?
I agree with the staff conclusion in this respect. However, in practice, many operators also lease assets from parties other than government. Guidance on what falls within the definition infrastructure in which the decision is applicable will be helpful. For example, a public bus operation leasing buses from non-public private companies over short-term lease. Are the buses under operating leases form part of the infrastructure? If yes, such operating lease for buses will be recognized on statement of financial position. Furthermore, this is tenure may not be consistent with the right of the services concession. If such leases are capitalized, amortization over operating period of service concession may not be reflected.
Tony?
A couple of thoughts, and I think I understand the way that the argument is built up in the staff paper. I guess I'm not convinced by an analogy to IFRS 16 to think about the basis for recognising the liability when we've already concluded that the arrangement isn't a lease. And so I think it would be necessary to consider in each arrangement whether the counterparty has done whatever it has to do before you get to a liability. And I just think, having said it's not a lease, deciding that it is the lease guidance that gets you there. I know that doesn't appear in the agenda decision, and the agenda decision says take into account all facts and circumstances, but I do think you would need to take into account, you know, what is it that the counterparty that the operator is going to have to pay actually has to do. I think that the piece that I continue to struggle with is to put this in the context of the financial asset model, and to think about a situation in which the lessor is under common control with the grantor, so you are dealing with the government, so this is entirely an arrangement with your customer, because the government is the customer when you're in the financial asset model. And I look at IFRS 15, which says if you make a payment to your customer, then you recognise the payment to the customer at the later of making the payment or delivering the related goods or services. And I just wonder whether it is completely clear that when the grantor and the lessor are under common control and you have an arrangement with your customer, that you would necessarily be required to gross up the balance sheet at the beginning of the period. And so I think I preferred this when it looked at the arrangements with a third party separately from the situation in which the grantor and the lessor are under common control.
You'd say common control rather than related parties, because we fussed over that last time.
I know we fussed over that, and I'm thinking about a situation where it is all the same government.
Okay. Bob?
I can understand the result that the staff describes in the agenda decision and can accept it. I think that we need to provide a little more clarity on the journey on how you get there, because I don't think that is the only potential answer and the only potential journey. I think a potential journey that we're rejecting is one which says that the operator leases the infrastructure and then subleases it to the grantor, which would give you a very different, you could also view it as an agent. But I think what we're saying is the journey is to get this result is that based on these facts and circumstances, the grantor is leasing the infrastructure, and then the operator accepts the liability to the lessor as payment or as consideration for the service concession. I get it. I think we just need to give people a little bit more explanation of that.
Brandon, did you want to come back on that?
I suppose I'll just make a couple of points. I don't know whether this is hopefully helpful. First of all, to clarify that, yes, Bob, at least that's our thinking in doing the analysis, that you only ask the questions about recognition and presentation or if you've already passed the test that it is a service concession arrangement. And we definitely, the first step we're saying is look, facts and circumstances, you really need to look closely as to whether it is a service concession arrangement. But having crossed that step, then we pick up what IFRIC 12 clearly says, which is in any service concession arrangement, by definition, the operator, you know, does not control the use of any of the infrastructure, which is why in this we haven't contemplated that if it's a service concession, that you would ever say that the operator has first of all leased the infrastructure in and therefore kind of controlled the use before it went out. Because it's a service concession, they don't control the use. Therefore, in this scenario, we're thinking that, you know, it's the grantor who is effectively the lessee of the infrastructure in this transaction.
Now, I think that answer will necessarily, I get it, and accept that. I think it will put a lot of pressure on determining whether the grantor really controls, but that's fine. That's just decisions we're going to have to make in practice. The one question I had that came up late, and sorry, maybe bring up painful, many of the leases, or the leases may contain variable rents. Now, for the operator, this isn't in IFRS 17 or IFRS 16. We're saying that they don't have the lease. Now, these rent payments, variable rent payments, would be, I would assume, outside of their control, because it's the, again, the grantor who determines when this infrastructure is run. They would affect whether the rents are incurred or not. How do we deal with that in this liability, or does that go back to the agenda decision we had last meeting?
I think
we
so.
Just say it's, we're not dealing with it.
I was just going to say, I think this goes back to the issue we're discussing on payments made by an operator in situations where they happen to be variable, and the issues that arise out of this would be very similar to what we're discussing in that arrangement.
Hyung-Soo?
I just want to say I support the staff conclusion. I just looked at this scenario in a little bit different perspective. I looked at this scenario as a kind of combination of two contracts. The first contract is the contract between the operator and the lessor, which is the leasing contract. So we can apply the IFRS 16. And the other one is a service concession arrangement contract between the grantor and the operator, where you can apply the IFRIC 12. So if you think these two contracts occurred at the same time, or in a sequence, but within a very short period of time, I think we can get to the same conclusion as the staff concluded. So no matter what we did, we can get to the same conclusion. So I support the staff conclusion.
Arden?
Yeah, I understand that for presentation and recognition issues, we do not refer to IFRIC 12 AG2 any longer, and I believe that's the right solution. However, if we are in the financial assets model, I guess also in January, we have we decided that the application of IFRS 15 then is required. However, with regard to IFRS 15, we have a more general question. I believe it's not solved yet. It is the question of revenue transactions between entities under common control. I'm not sure whether IFRS 15 really will have a clear wording on that issue, and therefore for presentation issues, it would be very important to come up with a kind of solution there, because also this affects the presentation then later on of the overall setup.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just ask, because I know both, and maybe it's a question for Tony and Martin, because you've both mentioned financial asset model in particular, and I suppose at least in thinking about the questions asked here, we didn't at all distinguish between, you know, whether this was a service concession that you end up in the financial asset model or whether you're in the intangible asset model, and more because we thought there was a particular fact in the fact pattern that led us there, which is to say that if in this case the operator is obliged to make the payments to the lessor, actually separate from what the operator gets paid from the grantor for the service concession, he has an unconditional right to obtain cash from the grantor, which is separate. So almost we thought the accounting that the operator does shouldn't be influenced per se by what, you know, whether it's financial asset model or intangible asset model, because there is this unconditional right to get cash back for any lease payments made separate from, you know, whether he's getting paid cash or, you know, sort of an intangible in a sense for the actual.
Okay, let's bring Carl in and then back to Tony.
I share very similar concerns to Bob and Tony. I think especially my main discomfort is about the liability initial recognition, the timing of the recognition of the liability. I think it's inoffensive when we are in the financial asset model. However, if the discussion was the intangible asset model with variable payments, with very long-term payments, the level of concern would be totally different. Therefore, I struggle with the argument made based on the IFRS 16, but with no reference in the agenda decision. And I would bring back the concern of if in this situation of service concession arrangements, we should mirror IFRS 16 as well to variable payments, not only initial recognition.
Yeah, we've kind of passed over that ground, haven't we? But Tony?
So to respond to Katrina's question, I think if we end up in the financial asset model, then we're in a model that says the grantor of the service concession is the operator's customer. And so there's a right to cash, obviously, for the operation of the service concession over the period. And if you then say at the same time that you're dealing with two branches of the government, and so the lessor is under common control with the government, however you set it up, the whole thing is an arrangement with the customer. And if you have the whole thing being an arrangement with the customer, I just wonder whether, well, firstly, whether it makes any sense, but then we've got to understand we have to interpret the guidance to say, I've agreed to have a stream of cash flows going this way with my customer at the same time I've got a stream of cash flows going that way, whether grossing up makes sense. And so I look to IFRS 15 and say, if this is an arrangement with my customer, then I would look at an obligation to make payments to my customer and recognize it following the guidance in IFRS 15. I agree with you, if the counterparty is a third party, then I agree with the way the analysis is set out. I just wonder if this is the only way of looking at it, if I'm in a financial asset model and the entire arrangement is with my customer.
So you're just on the gross versus net.
Yeah.
Shall we?
No, I think I'm just going to say, because step one of our analysis, in cases where they're both controlled by the same party, there could be more situations in practice, we think, where this is actually just structured as a flow-through mechanism. And I think that would be captured in step one of our analysis, where the operator has to assess whether it has an obligation to begin with. If it's truly a pass-through, we think the operator would not have an obligation, and basically would be the same effect of recognizing it net. If you do say that it has an obligation, it depends on the rights. If they do have separate rights and obligations with two different legal entities, then we think that affects whether you have an asset or liability. But
That point and extend it, I didn't see any reference to flow through, particularly in the agenda decision. As to whether there will be, I know you say you recognise a liability considering all the facts and circumstances, but that didn't come through to me from the agenda decision.
Isn't that because if I look on the page 12, the second page of the agenda decision, under small Roman numeral 1, we're intended to cap it by saying, look, it assesses whether it's obliged to make the payment. Maybe do we need to be clear and say, well, if it is obliged, it recognises the liability. If it's not obliged, it does not recognise the liability?
I guess the broader question, whether or not if it's all an arrangement with the customer, whether or not... But go on.
Well, it's just, I'm just trying to process what you're saying, Tony, but I don't think that guidance under IFRS 15 should be a route to saying, if you have an obligation, you end up not recognising that obligation. I mean, it just seems that, I'm not sure I see the analogy there, because I think if there is an obligation, surely it should be recognised, and I think that guidance is in a different context, and it's almost like what you're saying is that guidance would allow you to say that you don't end up recognising a liability for which you have an obligation.
Yeah, and maybe I'd only add to that if I understand, you know, what you're saying is you're picturing a scenario where the grantor and the lessor are both under common control, effectively then can be considered to be one party. And it's almost, if that's the case, then almost we're saying there is no lease transaction. So there is, the lessor isn't given to the grantor any lease in a sense. And I just think that if that's the substance of the arrangement, chances are the contract will reflect that, And as Javed said, there won't be any, you know, the operator in that case won't actually have taken on any risk and won't have an obligation and a right from the grantor, you know, effectively it will end up
and,
where.
And that is the type of arrangement that I'm thinking about. So when you've got the grantor and the lessor are under common control, and so you're going to get streams of cash flows that end up going round in a circle, and I'm questioning whether or not grossing up the balance sheet, recording finance expense and finance income really reflects the substance of that. And what I couldn't get from the way, maybe it's the way the agenda decision is drafted, as to whether or not in that circumstance you would still see grossing up for the cash that's effectively going round in a circle with the same counterparty.
Let me challenge that just a little bit, or a lot, I don't know. I'm thinking of a circumstance in which I have a government-owned railroad. Mm-hmm. I can think of one jurisdiction in which this is the case. And they have a service concession, effectively. But the government-owned railroad is a reporting entity. It reports its own financial statements. I don't even know whether it's consolidated at the government level. But the government wants to see what the railroad would look like if it was a normal business entity rather than government-owned. In that circumstance, I'm not sure that I'd reach the conclusion about offsetting that you do, because I may have different risks at the railroad level than I have at the federal government level.
Agreed, you might. Okay. Yeah.
So you're saying there are many circumstances in which you would continue to gross up.
I'm saying that I didn't get from this, the way it's drafted, that there might be circumstances in which, say, grantor and lessor are the same party, not really considering whether the operator is also under common control, but thinking just about the lessor and the grantor being okay. Effectively the same government. And what we've got is cash going round in a circle. And whether it makes sense in that context to have the balance sheet grossed up and finance income and finance expense grossed up.
I didn't pick up on that point, but I apologize.
So I think that's the same point that Martin was making.
Yeah, and I think I suppose the way we've worded this is though to is almost to say that if the contracts are written to reflect what you're saying the substance is in that scenario, then you would get the accounting that I think you're saying is appropriate in that scenario. If, however, we think the substance is such that, you know, this is all just one body and the cash flow's going around, but the contracts still say the operator is on the hook for the payments, regardless of whether he gets paid from the grantor, then all we're we're kind of saying, okay, reflect the contract, and I think we get to your answer as long as the contracts reflect the substance.
Charlotte?
Yeah, I think the same point. It's almost adding to B or to 2. If you're obliged to make the payments regardless of what goes on at the grantor level, or the profit, then it's clearly two separate obligations. But I suppose it is the question that we did touch on last time, of when are you acting as an agent or not? I think here it almost saying that if you've got the credit risk on the cash, then you're not an agent, then it's a gross up.
Yeah. Okay. John?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not so much an issue of agent as to whether the two contracts need to be considered as one instrument for the purposes of accounting. I think that's what Tony, I mean, I don't see this as an IFRS 15 issue, because I think even though you might have consideration payable to a customer under IFRS 15, once you go to IFRS 9, I think you have receivables and payables if they're between different parties. But, and then the offsetting rules would apply. But it seems to me the question here might be whether these two contracts need to be considered as one instrument for the purpose of accounting. It's a linked sort of instrument issue to me, rather than either a principal agent issue or an IFRS 15 issue.
Okay.
I just have one moment. I think what's an interesting extension of what John said, and I think this does come through in the fact pattern. Where I can see IFRS 15 being relevant, or at least something that we think about, is if the all of the payments from the grantor were dependent on operating the service concession. Because then you're saying, well, actually, all of my income is coming from my customer, and I'm making a payment to my customer. If the cash is purely circular, in connection with the lease payments, then I can see why you might not end up in 15. But if all of the income is conditional on operating the concession, then I can see how you might begin to think about IFRS 15.
And I suppose we very much based our analysis on the fact that in the fact pattern submitted, it said, yeah, there was the separate with unconditional right from the grantor.
Okay. The question is, support for the staff recommendation not to take this onto the agenda. Show of hands.
With some tweaks?
With some tweaks. We haven't gotten to the wording of the agenda decision. But the staff recommendation that we not take this onto the agenda. Okay. Now, the tweaks to the agenda decision. Wade, can you summarize for us what have been suggested as tweaks?
The way I understood it, one of the tweaks was to be clear that if it is a flow-through, then basically the operator does not have an obligation if the fact pattern is a flow-through. That was the main one that I picked up from the discussion. Was there anything else that people had major concerns with?
I think that would be confusing.
But the argument was made on this.
Yeah, the argument was made in the agenda, in the paper. we talked about that yesterday. It's a little, I find it troubling to refer to a standard that is not yet effective as the basis for applying a particular accounting.
We do it.
Bob?
I was looking for the tweak again for the journey, how we were viewing this, what was the basis for that, and what we rejected.
I mean, I don't know whether it's maybe for now or afterwards, Bob. I'd be interested to what do you think is missing, and then because I'm not sure what piece of the journey.
Yeah. Well, the journey is that the I'm specifically looking for the operator took on the liability to the lessor in consideration for the service concession, and the lease is between the grantor and the lessor.
I just think about that. Yeah, I'm not saying that. Sorry, I can't process as to whether I think already that causes me.
Okay, Carl, you wanted to come back in and respond to my comment.
Just we do arguments on IFRS 15 and IFRS 9 all the time. I'm not seeing why we can't do arguments. We can do reference on IFRS 16.
Just on this, on the wording here, we do say if the operator is obliged to make payments to the lessor, then the operator recognizes the liability when it is committed to the service concession arrangement and when the infrastructure has been made available by the lessor. So I think that kind of captures the rationale and the thinking that the operator should follow, and I'm not sure we necessarily need the reference to 16. We capture the thought process in the agenda decision wording.
Those who would, Carl's proposal is, I think, not necessarily to change the analysis in the agenda decision, but to make an explicit reference to IFRS 16. I guess what you would probably say then is, I guess on the second page of the agenda decision, item little two, you'd add somewhere consistent with the analysis, the rationale in IFRS 16, words to that effect. That's what you'd like to do. How many would support that as opposed to leaving it alone? Okay. Fails for lack of a second. All right, then we just have the one tweak.
And Bob's
adding the roadmap,
yeah,
the journey.
Okay. And just to clarify, we'll just, I think, I have no problem talking about pass-through. I think we'll just need to be careful that we don't stick in the word pass-through without defining it in some way, because it needs to be attached to contract. So.
Yeah, good luck with that. Sue?
We just need to be a bit careful because that language is actually used in a sort of official sense in IFRS 9 and 39. So.
Yeah, and it's very clear here. It's not. Yeah, it's not just because you.
I think Tony was not using it.
I'm not using it.
Yeah, I know.
John?
Best not to use a word that's defined in the process.
Yeah. Yeah, that was just going to be my comment, that if we start referring to flow-throughs affecting the recognition of assets liabilities, we need to be really careful because
it needs to be done in the context of linking to what the contracts say.
Yeah. Okay. You'll see the revised wording in update. I think we know how to do it. All right, then. Moving on to